Whatever Putin is saying is belied by his actions. The fact is, Ukraine is still being invaded. The fact is, Navalny was murdered. The reason NATO exists is because when Russia was a Soviet Union, it expanded into Eastern Europe after the Second World War, and people in Eastern Europe will not live under Russia again. I was just turned 20 before I went to Vietnam. Eventually, I became a gunner on a helicopter. As a result of my time in the war, I was very much against the war because I felt that whatever else our purposes were there, we were destroying the country. On 30 April 1975, I think a lot of us felt a real sense of tragedy. Talk about civil war in Vietnam. It's really a civil war between the two peoples for the same land. For me, an obvious solution then is, well, how do you learn to live together? We bombed Vietnam more heavily than we bombed during World War II. What I had been told to go there is that we were helping the Vietnamese to be free. When I went, I believed that. They're going to be much better off without us.
Hello, Wayne.
Hello, Andy. Nice to see you.
Likewise, likewise. How are you? How's everything on your end?
Everything is a nice cold February here in the States. You're in the summertime down there, right?
Yes, it's nice and warm down in Sydney. Whereabouts in the States are you located, Wayne?
I'm in Southern Maryland, down near the Chesapeake Bay, where the Chesapeake Bay goes into where the Potomac River goes into the Chesapeake. So it's about 60 miles southeast of Washington, D.C.
Okay, so you're on the East Coast. Okay, so that
on on the East Coast, yeah.
Thank you for doing this so late. I really appreciate it. I know it's definitely, I could tell it's sundown, so I appreciate you doing this, Wayne.
Oh, my pleasure.
Awesome. So, Wayne, I recently came back from a family trip in Vietnam literally a week ago, and just going to Vietnam, exploring the country as a whole. My family comes from the south. Both my parents sort of escaped Vietnam on a boat after the ending of the war. And coming back to Vietnam, this is the first time doing a trip from south all the way to north. And I was able to go to the middle. I was able to learn about the Cuchi tunnels down in the south and learn about the Viet Congs and go to the north and see what it was like up there. And I was just fascinated about my ancestry and history, and that's what catalyzed me to reach out to you and sort of have you come on the podcast. I know you've wrote a lot of cool books and you've had a lot of interesting experiences in Vietnam, and that was the whole catalyst for this whole conversation.
Okay, thank you. Was that your first time back to Vietnam?
I went to Vietnam probably 3 times prior when I was younger. The last time was 10 years ago when I was 16, 14. And we only stayed in my family's hometown in Vung Tau, which is 2 hours away from Saigon, Ho Chi Minh. And we'd only stay there and visit our grandmother. And when she passed away, we stopped coming back. And this is the first time coming back to explore and have a holiday.
Fantastic. Yeah, my son and daughter-in-law, grandkids live in New Orleans. The Vietnamese community in New Orleans largely came from Vung Tau. They all pretty much left together on their fishing boats in 75 and ended up in New Orleans, where a lot of the shrimp trade is run by Vietnamese Americans now.
That is so cool. I think I remember watching this conversation you had, Wayne, on YouTube, and you're talking about how when you came back from the war, you had an opportunity to sort of go to all these different charity events regarding the war, and you were sort of traveling with this other lady that was in North Vietnam. Maybe she was like a soldier, or she was like in the medical, yeah. And you just being with her, and then after 1-2 months, you would ask yourself, when, where, what happened? You asked her, and then she then eventually asked you, and that was just fascinating, the sort of the conclusion you had that the South and North, there wasn't like an enemy maybe, and that's something I definitely wanted to dig into.
Well, it's that conversation took place before that trip we took. It was part of a lot of conversations. I've been invited with a number of other Americans, veterans who had become writers after the war, to meet with Vietnamese veterans of the other side of the war. Basically, the people we would have been shooting at if we'd met at that time. And the person you're talking about, her name is Le Minh Quay. She is a pretty, well-known writer in Vietnam. She became a writer after the war also. She was with these teenage girls from the north who were used along the, they formed units along the Ho Chi Minh Trail to keep it open. They would take out the bombs. Once bombs were dropped on the trail, they would defuse them or explode them. They would be guides. They would take the dead back, et cetera, et cetera. So we were at that conference. We all lived together for about a month in Boston. There'd always come a time when we'd ask the other person, well, where were you and when were you there? And we're basically trying politely to find out if we'd ever been in a place where we might have tried to kill each other. And I'd become, friendly with her, and we were sitting at breakfast one morning and asked that question. And it turned out that she had been on the Ho Chi Minh trails at a time when I was flying over them. I was a helicopter gunner. And looking at her at that time, I just had this very emotional experience that I remembered shooting down into that jungle. And of course, at the time I couldn't even see the target. We were just directed that there were enemy down there to shoot at them. But I had this sense, well, if she was there, I would have killed her, and I would have been glad to do it. I mean, that would, she would have been the enemy. And at the same time, she was looking at me, and it was, she would have been glad to see my helicopter come down in flames at that time. And here we are sitting at the breakfast table. And that friendship led to a creation of a anthology of stories that were written by people on all three sides of the war. So she had been a somebody who then, I mean, this was fairly early, this was 1995, and she had written some stories in which the Southerners were not portrayed as puppets or enemies, which was really the political thing to do in the North and in Vietnam at that time. And the Southern side was basically, you didn't talk about them. The cemeteries of the Southern soldiers had been bulldozed over. There were no monuments, et cetera. And, in one of her stories, she wrote about a Southern prisoner of war and the Northern nurse who was taking care of him, and this kind of love that they felt for each other. And it was a daring story to write because it was kind of a move towards reconciliation. So we had been writing back and forth after she went to Vietnam through another writer named Hoang Thai. And we decided, well, let's, we're writers. The way to really show people's humanity is through their stories. So let's put together this anthology. And then we decided also that it would not be complete unless it included the stories from the Southern side of the war also. I found a man named Trung Hung Son, who was a who came as a refugee in 1975. He is a literary scholar, very knowledgeable about the Vietnamese, the Viet Cu, overseas Vietnamese literature that was being written and published. And he's a literally a rocket scientist who worked at NASA, at the National Aeronautics and Space Agency. So he became our we became the three editors, one from an American veteran, a veteran of the North Vietnamese Army, and he was a veteran of the South Vietnamese Army who had left on by boat in 1975 and had come to the had managed to get to the Philippines with his family and then to the States. So the three of us, picked the stories from all sides, and that became the book. And then Lê Minh Khuê and Hoang Thai, other writer from the North who had helped and who speaks English very fluently, came to the States to do a book tour. And that's when we went all over the States with the book, et cetera. So that's probably the conversation you heard.
When I was sort of brought up, I was always brought up with this sort of view that, America was the good. America came into South Vietnam. They wanted to stop the spread of communism. Communism is this sort of really idealistic idea that in real life it just doesn't work. And Americans wanted to stop it being pushed from the north to south. The south didn't want communism. They wanted to be independent. Once the South and America lost, all of a sudden people in the South are like, I have a lot of relatives where now they can't have opportunities if they had family members that were in the war. Like if my grandfather was in the military and he was from the South, now my father or my uncles, they can no longer go to university or get similar opportunities. So it's tough in that sense. And then also hearing stories of, one of my great uncles being put in prison and just worked until he was just near exhaustion and near death, and our family had to come and pick him up, and he was a mess, and luckily he was able to recover. So I was sort of really fed this side of the story, and traveling to the north for the first time, I was open to the fact that maybe a lot of my views are skewed and maybe very biased. And that's something I definitely wanted to get your thoughts on, why.
Well, I don't think they're particularly skewed or biased. I mean, that was really the re-education camps were a fact, and the persecution of the people who had been on the southern side. You know, that was a fact. If they were in the army or had worked for the South Vietnamese government, that was a fact. That said, after my time in the war, and you know, as a result of my time in the war, I was very much against the war because I felt that we, you know, that whatever else our purposes were there, we were destroying the country, basically. You know, when you put that many people and that much firepower, et cetera, et cetera, that this was basically a civil war between the Vietnamese. We'd come in on one side, and what was happening was much more destructive than what would have happened if we had stayed out of it. I was against the war at the same time. That didn't mean I was blind to what was happening to the southern Vietnamese, you know, after the war, to the people who had been on that side. It was really a matter of what would do the least, you know, what would do the least harm. It's interesting now that a number of the writers that I know and work with from Vietnam are dealing with that issue. You know, I mentioned Lê Minh Khuê, but Nguyen Phan Khoi Mai, who you might have heard of, and you know, who went to school in Australia, actually, when you know, in her, she wrote a very popular novel in English that's been very, you know, bestseller in the United States and Europe and around the world, called The Mountains Sing. And in that novel, it's about a Vietnamese family going through Vietnamese history from the time of the Great Hunger and land reform and all of that through the war and then after the war. And the family is split so that one of the main characters' uncles, you know, fought for the South and the others fought for the North. And after the war, they come together again. And you know, he had been in a re-education camp. And you know, the tone of the novel is reconciliation. It's we've been through this and it's been terrible, and there have been terrible things that were done by both sides, by all three sides. I, you know, include the Americans in this, and a lot of pain. And you know, now is a time of healing, and I think you see more of that happening in Vietnam. I did a nonfiction book. This relates to the question in this way. It was about a American soldier who had killed a North Vietnamese soldier face to face, and he took a diary from him. And 30 years later, he wanted to find the family of the man he'd killed and bring the diary back. And he asked me for help with that because he knew I had contacts in Vietnam. We were able to find the family and come back with him, you know, to meet them. And they were very, you know, they were forgiving. They were happy that he'd kept that notebook because it meant that, you know, some of the soul of their lost one could come home. They never knew what happened to his body. And the book is about that. And I went there and I interviewed the family, you know, a number of times. And I got, you know, they're very friendly with them. One time I went with a friend of mine, Nguyen Ky Duc, who, you know, speaks English very well, and he was translating for me when I interviewed them. And he asked the question, and they were talking about all of the missing in action. There were 300,000 missing in action on the Vietnamese side. Their bodies were never found or located. And he said, "How do you feel about the missing in action from the South Vietnamese soldiers that side?" And one of the family members said, "You know, they were traitors. They were puppet soldiers. It doesn't matter what happened to them." And he didn't say anything. And they didn't know who he was. They didn't know his background. And his background was that his father had been a South Vietnamese government official who had been captured during the Tet Offensive. They lived in Hue and had been taken north as a prisoner and remained in prison camps for 15 years. And Duc and his mother and family had come to America, you know, after 75, while his father was still in prison. They eventually reunited. But Duc said to me afterwards, after we left the family, you know, "Don't they know that my father loved Vietnam as much as they did?" And I put that in the book, you know, and the book was, you know, it was published in America, but there was a Vietnamese translation published in Vietnam, and the family read the book. And the first time I went back to visit that family, and the brother who had said that, he came out to greet me. And the first thing he said to me was, "You tell Nguyen Ky Duc that he should come back and he'll always be welcome in my house." It's like he read that and felt badly about the reaction, you know, and to me that was, you know, I think there was a lot of important things that came out of that book, but that was one of the most important things, that there was that need to reconcile that was felt, you know, in that case.
One thing that surprised me, and sort of affirmed my sort of beliefs was like, even the people in the north wanted to move and migrate to the south, even before the war. And then after war, like now when you go to Ho Chi Minh, you go to Saigon, it's filled with people from the north. And, you know, I hear that Saigon Ho Chi Minh drives a large percent of the GDP for Vietnam. So if the country stayed separate, North Vietnam would not be flourishing and would be struggling. Like North Vietnam is being funded by the south. And then that also sort of added more confusion. It's like the people of the north liked the south and wanted to migrate to the south. And it seems like the south is where the good people are.
Well, it's a matter also of land and climate that, the north is prone to flooding, to seasons where you can't grow. I mean, the south is much richer agriculturally, in all of those ways. You have that, and you did have a lot. I mean, that was the case with, I mentioned the writer Nguyễn Văn Quế Mai. Her family did that. They were from the north, and after 75, they moved to Bạc Liêu in the Mekong Delta because they could have more, they could have more land and, et cetera. And there was resentment in the south also of people coming from the north because, they were taking land and jobs, et cetera. I think, I mean, the economy is driven by so many different things, but you still have that sense that the south is a richer, area of a country. Are you familiar with the writer Bao Ninh, who wrote The Sorrow of War? So he was a North Vietnamese soldier. He wrote this book that was, it also, it's pretty well internationally known. A lot of it's autobiographical. He was in a North Vietnamese army unit where there were, out of 500 of them, he was one of the 10 that survived. And in part of that novel, he writes about the soldiers being in the South and staying at this farm. And they're saying, if we win the war, these people are not going to have this good a life. The farm that they have, which was privately owned and all that, because they'd gone through collectivization and everything else, they're not going to have that good a life. There was that, and the soldiers were told not to say anything good about the South when they went back home to the North. So you had that split. As far as the economy, I'm not an economist. I don't know what drives it. I know that attitude and certainly that those facts about the agriculture and climate of the country that's always made the South, that much more attractive.
Maybe it's sort of due to the environment, but another thing I was sort of taught or subconsciously taught was like people in the South are carefree, warm people, but people in the South, they talk without thinking, they're less eloquent, whereas people in the North are much more reserved, more calculative, more sneaky. I definitely sort of do see that, but obviously going to the North, there were people that didn't follow those trends, but the North as a whole did feel like that. I don't know if that's because I was taught that since I was young, but that's another thing I was taught.
Yeah, I think that attitude's pretty prevalent. I mean, that if you're a northerner, your attitude is that we are more stoic and tough, and the southerners are more carefree and, musical and open and everything else. The northerners don't consider themselves sneaky. That's a southern, prejudice. But and then, for southerners, yeah, they have that same, that idea. We are much more open and easier to laugh, et cetera, et cetera. So that exists.
One thing that surprised me, I was having a back and forth conversation with this tourist. I think he was from Spain. He was traveling south to north of Vietnam, and I was sharing my experience of that the south people were warm. Yes, in Ho Chi Minh, people might be rude, but they sort of want to sort of give you a good service or give you nice food. But everyone's cheery. Whereas in the north, everyone felt really cold. They felt like there was a bit of snobbery. Like, my Vietnamese isn't that good. Like, I have a very, my Vietnamese is pretty bad. And I had a metaphor. It's like in the south, my bad Vietnamese comes off as cute, whereas in the north, it comes off as stupid. And then the tourists I was talking to, they were saying, no, I had the complete opposite experience. I felt like people in the south were really rude and people in the north were really respectful and kind. And it was the complete opposite of my experience.
Yeah, there you go. It depends on who you meet, obviously. But I think those stereotypes prevail. I mean, I've heard them a lot, and some of it has to come from, that goes back to what we were just talking about. When you're in a place where it's easier to farm and to have food, and I mean, 2 million people starved to death in the north during the Second World War and the Great Hunger. You didn't have that happen in the south. I mean, when you have that type of tougher existence, it makes for more stoic people in that sense. So, yeah, I think that's there also. And then, I mean, there was so much censorship of the arts under communism, that really didn't start to crack until, the mid-80s when they instituted the renovation policy. But it's still, I mean, the people in the, the music, for example, when the there was very popular music that was called yellow music, in particularly in the South, but it was enjoyed in the South and the North. And then after 75, that was forbidden. It was too joyful, it was too capitalist, it was too, et cetera. The same with poetry and fiction and film, et cetera, et cetera. There was a lot of censorship of that that, that I'm very cognizant of because it's always, those are the people I work with. And there's been a lot of loosening of that. It's not what it was after the war or anything like that, but still it goes back and forth. And I don't know where I was going with that as far as North and South go, but
Yeah, one thing I've been like trying to understand and question is like, why did America go to war in Vietnam? Like, I understand why maybe World War I, World War II might have happened. Like Germany was like Hitler was just killing a bunch. There was mass genocide. That sort of makes sense. I understand why they maybe went to the Middle East. There was a lot of oil. But like, what was there in Vietnam for them to gain going to war? Like, is it similar to the Ukraine-Russia situation that's happening now, where it's just sort of it's a proxy war for the West versus the East, Russia versus America, and Vietnam's just a proxy war for that? Like, why did America go to war?
it was very much a proxy war. You have to understand American foreign policy after the Second World War. In the Second World War, we were supporting Ho Chi Minh, because he was anti-Japanese, and we were sending OSS advisors to Ho Chi Minh at that point. And he begged America to stay out of it, basically. And when he did his Declaration of Independence in September of 1945, he used the American Declaration of Independence. He used those words. And part of that strategy was, America, don't support the French, stay out of it. But, after the Second World War, particularly in the 1950s, we're in the Cold War. And American policy was based on the idea of the domino theory, that if the communists take over one government, it will lead to another falling and another falling and another falling. So if Vietnam goes communist, then Laos and Cambodia will go communist, and Thailand and Burma, et cetera, because China had already gone. And, we were in a cold war with the Soviet Union and then with the Chinese as well. So NLF started to win in South Vietnam when the North started sending troops, et cetera. I mean, this was under Kennedy. The idea is, we have to stop the communists anywhere. So we start sending advisors. And then the more that the South started losing, the more we started sending until 65, when Lyndon Johnson just sent American started sending American ground troops into Vietnam. It was very much what you said, a proxy war. We were fighting the Soviet Union and China. We were fighting against, the spread of international communism, which, turned out to be wrong, since it wasn't that long after we left. Not that long after 75, when Vietnam was in a war with communist Cambodia, and then in a war with communist China. There was no monolithic, communism that actually existed as that kind of a threat. It was, much more Vietnamese, the Vietnamese Communist Party, but nationalism, both the North and the South, in their own ideological ways, saying, we need to be independent. We need to be not under the control of any foreign power. And for the North, for the Communist Party, fighting the French for all those years, now the Americans were coming in. No, we're not going to accept that. For the South, well, we're not going to accept the communists because, they're part of the whole communist system. So it's really, a war generated on the Vietnamese side by nationalism, two different interpretations of nationalism, but nationalism. And on the American side, it was, no, we're fighting to stop international communism. And I remember people would say during those times, if you don't stop them there, they're going to be in California, take Hawaii, et cetera. We got to stop them over there.
When I was going on these different tours in Ho Chi Minh, South Vietnam, Saigon, there were a lot of sort of South Vietnamese tour guides that, I felt this sense of confliction where they were people who were born in the South. Like, they had this sense of like they would have wished for the Americans to stayed and not pulled troops. They would have wished for Americans to help them win the war. And as they're telling the tourists the story of how, Vietnam is now united, there's sort of this conflict because they're trying to say the uniting of the countries is a good thing. And then, they still want to call Saigon Saigon, but now they have to call it Ho Chi Minh. So I sense that conflict and that sort of want and yearn for wish that America would have stayed and helped them win.
I think the wish that they would have won is the bottom line on that. And that's certainly the attitude that I've heard in the South and that I've heard about Vietnamese Americans that I talk to. Why did you leave? Why did you abandon us? Why did you pull out in 75? As I said, my own view is that us being there caused a lot more harm than result was going to be inevitable in any case. But what you describe is a reality, I think, for a lot of people in the South and for a lot of overseas Vietnamese as well.
Did the American soldiers want to leave? Were you guys relieved to be called back home? Or did you feel like there was unfinished business?
I mean, for the real professionals, I think, they felt that way. The career soldiers, not all of them, but many of them. For most of us, it was survive your tour, and for Marines, that was 13 months. For the Army, it was 12 months. Survive that and get home. It wasn't a matter of, I think for most of us, it wasn't a matter of we feel like we're unfinished business. On 30 April 1975, I think a lot of us felt a real sense of tragedy and a real sense of waste. What had all that been about? Why did my friends die there? What did we accomplish? For most of us, it wasn't a matter of wanting to stay to finish the job. And I say most of us because, I'm not going to say that there weren't people that felt like that. I know there were. I know people who felt.
Yeah. When you mentioned the day, 30th of April, ironically, that's my birth date.
Was it really? Wow.
Yeah, very. It's something that my dad sort of, it's like an interesting fact my dad would like to pull when he meets Vietnamese people, introduces me as his son. But yeah, like I hear that on that date in Vietnam, it's sort of this celebration day. It's like the day that Vietnam got united, everyone has to put out flags. But then for a lot of, people in the South or people in my family, it's sort of a day of sadness. It's a very sort of sad day.
Yeah, it's do you call it a victory day or a defeat day? It depends on what side you were on. Again, it was a civil war, and there's a winning side and a losing side. That's natural. People are going to feel that way.
What
I mean,
happened?
the only thing is, most of you, your generation and younger, most people in Vietnam were born after the war, and same thing for most overseas Vietnamese. So that's gonna, I mean, I think it's gonna fade. I think that's eventually it's gonna become something abstract and historical and everything else. But certainly for the generations that fought on both sides, that's gonna be a very significant day. And it's not something that goes away for any of us.
Wayne, something that you brought up was how after the war, Vietnam ended up fighting Cambodia, and Cambodia was a communist country, which seems ironic because Vietnam won and now they're communist, so why are they fighting a communist country? That's something you brought light to me just then. In my mind, I thought it was just Cambodia. Pol Pot was this evil dictator that was just killing tons of people, and Vietnam wanted to come in as the savior and stop this massacre. Was that the case or not?
It was partially the case that they wanted to stop the massacre, et cetera, but it was also because Cambodia was moving in places in Vietnam, was raiding, and because there was a conflict with China. China was supporting Pol Pot, so it was again for the Vietnamese. It was a in terms of policy, it was another kind of war of independence. We're not going to be controlled by anybody. We're not going to be controlled by China, who we fought for thousands of years for independence, even though we're both communists and even though they were our allies during the war, et cetera, et cetera. But for Cambodia, I mean, there were some altruistic reasons that, to stop the genocide that was, self-genocide that was going on, but also because the Cambodians were raiding into South Vietnam, places in the Mekong, et cetera.
Interesting. Yeah, that confuses me. So China supported North Vietnam to win the war, and then China then supported Pol Pot, who then was taking land and taking parts of Vietnam. So that seems like the opposite.
Yeah, confusing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's nations have their perceived self-interest that they're going to act out of. And your friend one day may be your enemy the next day. It really depends on what are perceived as the interests of your nation.
Got it. So, like, let's say Vietnam fought back Cambodia to sort of have its independence that it has today. But I'm always hearing sort of whispers that, Vietnam is China's little brother. That, like, Vietnam, like, China has bought up, like, Nha Trang and it's buying it. And whatever China says, Vietnam has to do. So, this whole battle for independence, is Vietnam that independent, or are all these rumors that I'm hearing quite true and it's like all their battles went to naught?
I won't say that there were riots against the Chinese not that long ago in Vietnam because of fish poisoning and people building casinos everywhere and stuff like that. So it's still, I can't see Vietnam ever accepting itself as China's little brother or puppet. But all over Asia, Chinese are making economic incursions, and they're not just doing it in Vietnam, and they're doing it with building things and with companies and building highways in Myanmar and all this dams, et cetera, et cetera. So that's been going on. I think I get more of the sense, when I go to Vietnam, how you see American and European and Australian companies everywhere. You see very healthy capitalism going on. In that sense, the question of who won the war is also something you could ask. I think, in the end, I think Vietnam won one way or the other, but it's certainly not the Vietnam that Lê Duẩn and Ho Chi Minh, et cetera, envisioned in 1975 when the victory happened.
Yeah, all this talk about sort of China, that's sort of been my stance for some time. But then talking to these tourists that came to Vietnam, a lot of them were people from, South America, from Europe that now live full time in China. And they're telling me, they're like, China's amazing. It's super high tech. It's so ahead. It's going to be the next powerhouse. Like, no one can stop China. And they had nothing but positive things to say. And they came from probably a Western country. And I was like, huh. Like, one, I'm probably gonna have to go to China personally to see it for my own eyes and sort of figure out just like how I went to North Vietnam. But like, I'm hearing the complete opposite story on how China's this amazing high-tech booming country.
I can see why people would get that impression, but it's a kind of superficial impression. I mean, first of all, as foreigners, they're probably not so much affected by the authoritarianism that exists in China. They're probably, and also economically, look what's been happening in China with all of the real estate going bankrupt. So many people going bankrupt and desperate with the economy held back so much because of the draconian rules they had during the COVID epidemic. It's not all that successful economically these days. It's still, of course, a great power and the one of the rising powers in the world, but it's that picture that the tourists you're hearing from are painting is not that. I don't think it's quite that optimistic and shiny.
Wayne, have you watched that Tucker Carlson and Putin interview recently, Don?
I saw parts of it and then turned it off. It was kind of disgusting.
Interesting, because after watching that, like, Putin seems like an educated, not this power hunk. Like, he talked about wanting to stop the war. He wants to stop the war in Ukraine. He wants to have a negotiation with the people in America. And then the fact that Americans and the people in America were so against Tucker having that conversation, like, they wanted to censor the conversation and not have it happen, that also raised some red flags. Like, are people in the West fed propaganda that, yeah.
I don't think anybody tried to censor him. I thought whatever Putin is saying is belied by his actions. The fact is Ukraine is still being invaded. The fact is Navalny was murdered. The fact is, many that elections are not being allowed. The fact is that many of his critics have been murdered or imprisoned. He can say whatever he want. And my impression in the interview was basically Carlson was not asking any questions that really had any sting to them. He was not acting as a journalist. He was acting as like a PR man for Putin, which is why, I turned the thing off. So, the propaganda there was, I think, coming from Carlson's side, which is where it usually comes from. So, yeah, somebody can get on TV and say a lot of things, but you have to look at his actions.
Interesting. So, like, simple sort of statements that, like, hey, like, Ukraine agreed not to join NATO, and now NATO is trying to get Ukraine to join, or stuff people saying how people like Biden have economic interests in Ukraine and money is being funneled there. Do you think all these are probably conspiracy theories?
The stuff about Biden is certainly conspiracy theories. None of that has been proven, and there's been a lot of investigation, you know, which has come to naught. You know, as far as the threat of Ukraine going into NATO, the reason NATO exists is because when Russia was a Soviet Union, it expanded into Eastern Europe after the Second World War, and people in Eastern Europe will not live under Russia again. You know, certainly it's an American interest to have NATO, but it's also, you know, it's in the interest of the Europeans who are in it. Ukraine never said it was going into NATO, but even if it did, I mean, it's not a threat to Russia unless Russia invades. You know, the Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Finland, they're not going to invade Russia, you know, and certainly we don't want a war with Russia. We're not going to, you know, get NATO to invade Russia. It's a defensive tier. The only threat that happens to Russia is when Russia invades, which it did in Ukraine.
Is there an example of like a big propaganda that you were made to believe about the North Vietnamese that you have now come to found was propaganda and was not what you believed?
If I go back when I was in the war and before I went to the war, you know, just as a young American, basically they were faceless communist robots. That's how they were presented to us. They were puppets of Russia or China, and they were, you know, they were all robotic and et cetera, et cetera. So two of the things I learned was they were very good fighters, which meant they must have believed in something to fight as hard as they could. They did. And, you know, and then after the war, I got to know many people from all sides in Vietnam, and that was a very personal humanizing. But even before that, you know, it was like not till the mid-90s I started meeting people who had been on the other side and everything. I lost that idea of North Vietnamese just being communist robots, I guess. Long before that, it was just studying history, studying, you know, reading, et cetera, et cetera. I was disabused of all that kind of stuff. But then the real humanity came when I met people face to face. And, you know, and as a writer, reading their stories also. So getting to know them personally, but also, you know, you really get to know people through the stories that they tell you, the stories that they write, et cetera. It's a profound humanizing experience.
What do you think from the North's perspective was the worst thing that Americans or the South Vietnamese did? How were we or the Western or South Vietnamese demonized from the North's perspective?
Well, as I said, in a lot of ways, they still are. And after the war, they were very much demonized as puppets of the West. You know, so the equivalent of the communist robot is the American puppet, you know, South Vietnamese as an American puppet. There's that dehumanization. I think the worst thing was for the North Vietnamese was the bombing, you know, the bombing of the North, but also the bombing of the South, where, you know, I think Marilyn, there's a historian, Marilyn Young, who in her history of the Vietnam War, said that 9,000 out of 15,000 villages in the South were destroyed by American bombing. And then, you know, not only the bombing, we bombed Vietnam more heavily than we bombed during World War II in that small area. And then it's not just the bombing, it's the Agent Orange, it's, you know, all the chemical defoliants that were used and that are still causing harm to, you know, American veterans and much more in Vietnam, you know, generation to generation, where the soil's been poisoned, water's been poisoned, leading to deaths, to all of the deformed births, et cetera, that came out, you know, that came from that poison. So one of the organizations I support is called Project Renew. It's in Quang Tri Province, Central Vietnam. What's now Central Vietnam was right below the division, 17th parallel, the militarized zone during the war. And it's one of the places where I was in the war. There were, after 75 till now, there were literally tens of thousands of people killed or injured by bombs or artillery shells that are still, or mines that are still buried in the soil. And, you know, so the Project Renew there, what they do is they find and defuse or blow up the unexploded ordnance, or they educate people how to avoid it, educate children not to pick up little bombs, educate people not to pick up bombs to sell for scrap metal. I mean, it's just in that province, tens of thousands of deaths and injuries from the end of the war till today. I mean, When I say that I turned against the war because I felt like what I had been told to go there is that we were helping the Vietnamese to be free. And when I went, I believed that. And the experience I walked away with was that we were really devastating that country. They're going to be much better off without us. So I think the bitterness that remains from the war, I mean, you can literally still see it in the soil.
One thing that I wondered, like with all that bombing, why couldn't America simply end the war with one single nuclear bomb as it did in Japan? Was it due to the Cold War and Russia now also had nuclear bombs and that would have caused a nuclear war? Like, why tons of little bombs versus just one big bomb as it did in Japan?
And bomb Hanoi and Haiphong with one big nuclear bomb and end the war. First of all, that wouldn't necessarily have ended the war. It might have. Yeah, as long as you had people in the jungles, in the mountains, in the, you know, I mean, the French controlled Hanoi and Haiphong during the Indochinese War. That didn't stop, you know, the war from going on. The reason that's given, though, and you know, it's a true reason, is that we were afraid of getting China and Russia involved if we did that. It's why we didn't invade North Vietnam also. We kept our fighting south of the DMZ. We never tried to invade the North. We never put our entire armed forces into it for that matter. You know, and people say, well, all you had to do is invade the North. But I'm pretty sure that China would have come into it certainly, and the Soviet Union probably. We had that experience in Korea when, you know, once, you know, the communists came into South Korea, we came to Korea, we beat them back, and then we continued to the Yalu River. You know, we continued into North Vietnam and North Korea, and then the Chinese came into the war, and it became a much bigger war. So we were, you know, afraid of that happening. It was just, I think, the main reason we never invaded the North.
As I was talking to my dad, he was telling me the history of the country and how, you know, he can speak French because when he was young, he had to speak French, learn how to speak French because it was sort of colonized by the French. And then ironically, like it was the Communist Party that grew and fought against and had that French revolution and pushed the French out of the country. So it's sort of ironic that everyone wanted the French out. The communists were the ones that did that. And as they grew in power, they were like, we don't want communism. Like, and I found that very interesting that the party that took away the French was also the party they didn't want taking over the country.
Yeah, and the history's, it's also a little more complicated than that, in that when the fight began against the French, there were non-communist groups that were also involved in that fight that eventually were pretty much wiped out by the, or forbidden by the Communist Party, by the Communist Party. You know, it was the National Liberation Front. It was a front, you know, meaning more than one organization in it. And there were non-communist elements in that. And the same thing with the Viet Minh, which was, you know, the main group fighting against the French. I have a very good friend who's from the North, and his father was somebody who had actually worked with Ho Chi Minh. They're from Nam Dinh province, which is a very Catholic province, that area. And my friend's father was very, you know, religious Catholic, but he worked with Ho Chi Minh against the French until the Communist Party started purging Catholics. Then he was supposed to be assassinated, but he is by the Viet Minh, and he and his family escaped to the South in 1954. You know, and they were very anti-French. My friend caught polio because as a young kid, he had to hide overnight in the pond in his village when the French soldiers came into their village. And he and his sister both caught polio doing that, and his sister died from it. They were very anti-French and they fought against them, but then they were Catholic too. So when the Communist Party turned against the Catholics, they went south.
Another thing that when going to the Cuchi tunnels and learning about that, I was just surprised how they show this map. There was like blue, red, and like, I was like, how did the North manipulate the Viet Congs to have a big impact within the South? Like, how are they bringing resources from the North that deep into the South? And like the Cuchi tunnels, it's like an hour away from Saigon. So like, you guys are like fighting people on your own, like in your own backyard, and you're worried about the DMZ. So you're fighting in all directions and you can't differentiate who's North, who's South. I was like, wow, like this is a very messy battle. Like, yeah.
The Cuchi tunnels were literally parts under the 25th American Infantry Division, literally under the base camp, you know, of the division. Yes, I mean, first of all, the Viet Cong were Southerners. You know, they were people fighting against the Americans for the same reason they fought against the French. They were supported by the North, and there were northern visions that came into the South. But that, and again, that was the Ho Chi Minh trails, those trails that came through, the mountains along the western border and in Cambodia and Laos that were, basically highways getting to the South that we tried to interdict all the time, but could not stop. But I mean, and you had, is that combination of a civil war, North versus South, but it was also within the civil war is a revolution going on within the South against the Southern government by the Viet Cong. So yeah, you couldn't tell who was the enemy. A village would be, you go into a village and some of the people would be on the side of the Viet Cong. Some of the people would be on the government side. A lot of the people just wanted to farm their rice and stay the hell out of it, stay alive. But, for Americans, everybody looked alike, which was the cause of so many civilian deaths, because the way that problem was solved is just by not any lies where everybody was massacred, but certainly by calling in artillery or calling in bombs, et cetera, et cetera. You don't know who's in the village. You got fire from the village. Get rid of the village. Save American lives by bombing it. So.
With your sort of experience with what happened in Vietnam, we need to take a look at wars that US played a part in, whether it's the Middle East or right now Ukraine. Do you think America should just pull its resources and soldiers from these places and let the civil wars play out? Or do you think America should continue sort of playing a role in these sort of international sort of civil sort of wars?
It depends on the particular war. I think there's always a problem with that. People say we fought in Vietnam as if it was World War II. We use the World War II model of the Nazis not being appeased to apply that to the communists. And you have to take in whatever the real politic of the particular situation is before that. I don't think we can withdraw from the world. No, I don't think with what's been happening with an expansionist Russia and an expansionist China, I don't think America can, just withdraw from the world. As far as the individual conflicts, no, we have to be much wiser. Why did we get involved in Iraq? I mean, that was no gain for us whatsoever. There's nothing to do with the World Trade Center bombing in 2001. There's nothing, nothing to do with any of that. And I have, I taught in a college for 30 years. From 2005 to 2010, I'd say I started getting students in my class who were coming back from Iraq and then from Afghanistan. And they were going through all the same traumas that we had gone through coming back from Vietnam. And for a lot of the same reasons, because they were involved in a war where they didn't know who the enemy was. They didn't know who the friends were. There was no winning of it. It was just, constant trying to survive and get back home. I mean, and there was, certainly a justification to go into Afghanistan at the beginning, but not to stay there for 20 years. It depends on the situation.
What's your thoughts on the Ukraine and Russia situation? Is it similar to or different to the South versus North, the pushing of sort of the expansion of certain ideology? What's your read on the current Ukraine-Russia situation, and then what should America be doing?
I think we need to be supporting Ukraine. I think it's very clear that what the majority of Ukrainians want, which is their own independence. And I think both in terms of needing to feel like we are still committed to NATO, and in terms of simply its right, to help the Ukrainians in this war, that it's the right thing to do to support them. It doesn't mean sending American troops. And that's one thing that the Ukrainians have never asked for. We're not going to be involved in that way. They're not part of NATO. The only way that would happen is if they were part of NATO, that we'd, be sending American troops. As far as providing arms, training, et cetera, I think it's the right thing to do.
Interesting. Two part. One, do you think the Ukrainians' want for independence is stronger than the South Vietnamese want for independence before the war? And two, why couldn't America take the same approach and just send military arms and weapons? Why did America need to send soldiers into the South Vietnam?
Well, that was, I mean, we started out just doing that, right? Just sending arms and advisors in the early 60s under President Kennedy. Because when the South Vietnamese government started losing, after several very well known, battles, et cetera, Up Bok and so on, when they started losing, again, it went back to that Cold War mentality that they're going to lose, the communists are going to take over South Vietnam, and then they're going to take over Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, et cetera. And then, it was that domino theory, the attitude that we had, that Communism was a monolithic thing. Soviet, Chinese didn't make any difference. Vietnamese didn't make any difference. Monolithic thing. We had to stop it before it took over the world. We had waited, Europe had waited too long with Hitler to stop the Nazis. And now we were going to do the same thing with, unless we nipped that in the bud, unless we, got in there. But it was very controversial, even at the time in the States. It wasn't until Lyndon Johnson was president and the Gulf of Tonkin incident happened, in 65, which was largely faked. There was an attack, a North Vietnamese attack on an American destroyer the first day, the second day. This is not controversial. I mean, this is in the histories now that there was never an attack the second day. It was just either made up or mistaken radio chatter. And Johnson used that to start the bombing campaign of North Vietnam and then to send, Marines into Da Nang Harbor in March of 1965. So it was that, stop the communists, that was the thing.
Do you think, how does it differ to what's happening in Ukraine and Russia? Do you think it's like, did the South Vietnamese not want independence as much as the Ukrainians?
I think that many did. I think there was a great deal of corruption in the southern government, which spread into the army, and which even though there are many, South Vietnamese soldiers who fought very valiantly, and many in the South who wanted their independence, from the North, from, communism, et cetera, that it was part of our reason, for going in there. Part of our reason. Again, we would not have gone in there unless there was the whole idea of the communist threat, et cetera, et cetera. It's part of our reason. It's certainly part of what we were given as our reason. We were told we were helping the South, again, I went there, we were helping the South Vietnamese gain their freedom. And I just keep coming back to the fact that it was a civil war, the fact that it was a revolutionary war, the fact that we could not tell one side from the other, and we were causing so much damage because of that, that's still there till today, that no matter how, noble a cause that might have been for the South Vietnamese to want their independence, it was not worth destroying the country. There was a famous quote during the war by an American captain who was being interviewed on the news, and he said, I forgot the town, but it was one of the towns in the South that the Viet Cong had taken over, and he said, and they bombed it. We had to destroy the town in order to save it. And that kind of became a, encapsulation of what was wrong with the whole war. You can't save something by destroying it. You can only destroy it.
If you were to jump back in time and go back to Vietnam, is there anything the Americans could have done to win? Or do you think there was no way and the only solution is we should have not have gone to war in the first place?
I don't think with the degree of, I hate saying this because it's kind of become a cliche, but, with the degree of corruption in the South Vietnamese government and therefore the lack of support it had, from the countryside, that even though there were so many good people in the South, in the army and in the government as well, as people like my friend Duke said, don't you know my father loved Vietnam as much as any of you? That was there. But even that, I mean, from the fish rot from the head down, when you have that much lack of support and corruption, I don't think there's a way we could have won. There's a way we could have fought more intelligently. And actually the Marine Corps policy in the beginning tried to do that. What they did was instead of having these large scale operations going into the jungle and trying to find the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese and fight them and all that, they formed small units of Marines that would go into a village and then train the village militia, what we call the regional forces, and live there with them. So the idea, this was the Marine General Kulak, his idea is the only way you're going to win the war is if you win the countryside. And the only way you're going to win the countryside, that's the majority of people live in the countryside. That's it. The only way you're going to win the villages is, to have a presence there that's not a destructive presence that's going to, that people are going to. And you find the people who are in those units had the best relations with the Vietnamese and vice versa. I know guys in those units will go back today and they're still welcome. They're still heroes in those villages. And I think that would have been a much more intelligent way for us to, actually, and less destructive, way for us to fight the war. But again, it really depends. The war could only be won if the South Vietnamese government had the support from the population it needed.
That's such a cool story, Wayne. Thanks for sharing that. Are there any other cool strategic stories? Like, were there any generals that learned Vietnamese and really got into the culture and really had interesting strategies on sort of getting support and rally and training up the sort of South Vietnamese soldiers. Are there any other cool sort of strategic stories that come to mind?
I can't think specific anecdotes, but there were very intelligent commanders. Colonel Moore, who was at the Ya Drang battle, that was his policy. The General Kulak, as I say, but they were overruled by General Westmoreland, who was the overall general in charge. And it was his idea was, no, what, and again, he was a World War II general. You got to go out, find the enemy in the jungles and, have these large scale battles and et cetera, et cetera. But, it became the gauge of victory in the war became body count, because it wasn't a matter of, like in World War II, you'd land in Normandy in France and then go east, take Berlin. The war is over. Germans surrender, right? In the Pacific, you take all the islands and eventually get to Japan, drop the bomb. The war is over. In Vietnam, you go into the highlands, let's say, and have a battle and knock the North Vietnamese off a hill with many casualties, costing you many casualties and them many. And then 2 days later, you leave the hill and they come back. You go into you even with a village, you go and take a village, and then if you're not there all the time, you go out and then they come back in. So you could not win the war by taking territory. As I told you, we were not going to invade the North because of the threat of China and the Soviet Union. So the gauge of victory became body count. How many of them did you kill? And that became a way that too many civilians got killed because they got counted up with the bodies. We won today because we only lost 20 Americans and they lost 200. It's no way to fight a war.
Do you think if China and Russia sent soldiers to North Vietnam, like Americans sent soldiers to South Vietnam, the North would have won even quicker?
Well, they did send soldiers. They didn't send large amounts. They sent advisors. They sent anti-aircraft units. Some of my friends who fought in the Central Highlands are sure that they fought against some Chinese troops at one time. But I don't, that's never been documented. But they did have both Soviets and the Chinese had people in the North as advisors and as anti-aircraft crews, etc. But yeah, I don't know. Then it wasn't on a massive scale.
Yeah, because I was wondering, like, why is it fair that the North couldn't approach onto the South, but the South couldn't approach onto the North? If you guys both had soldiers from Soviets, China, America, like, it feels like a one-way battle.
Yeah, well, it was. As I said, we were afraid of, a wider war in that way.
I always hear people say, like, America profits from war. Like, what does that mean? Is that true? Like, America makes money when there's a war through selling arms. Like, so every time there's a war, America profits. Is that true? And how is it true?
Yeah, to some extent. I live in an area where there's a large naval air base nearby. I would say three quarters of the economy in the county where I live is military contractors making weapons, making, et cetera. And during the Iraq war, during the Afghanistan war, those folks are doing very well. They're making a lot of money because, they're making weapons and they're supporting weapons and they're, whatever. And it's a huge industry. So, I don't, does America profit because there's wars? There's areas of the American economy that profit because there's wars. There is a large defense industry in this country that certainly profits, when we have wars. Doesn't mean they start the wars, doesn't mean they keep them going, but they definitely profit from them.
Because, like, in my mind, like, how does it make sense? Like, if America is paying defense companies to make weapons to then give away and send to Ukraine, so that means the American government is just constantly printing money and getting more and more debt. But the military companies, they're making a ton of money, and they probably then all the resources, the metal companies, the tech, they probably make money. But then doesn't America as a whole just constantly get more and more debt as it's giving weapons away? Like, how does giving things away make you more money?
Because the defense industry is working to do that, they are getting government contracts to do that, and they are employing people, And they are, Ukraine's actually been profitable for us, for the defense industry. We're able to manufacture a lot of stuff to, in this case, to give to them. But still, it's the process of getting the contracts to manufacture it and to get the raw materials and to make it, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, we give it away, but it's still very much money making.
Got it. Wayne, what's your thoughts on what's happening in Palestine and Israel right now? That also is another big thing that's currently happening.
Yeah, it's very painful for me. I spent a number of years in the Middle East as a journalist. I'm very aware of that situation. I know people involved there and everything else. So I was horrified by what happened on October 7th with Hamas, and I'm horrified at the disproportionate extent of the retaliation in Gaza. I think what has to happen, I mean, what has to happen is a, I don't think will happen very soon, but the ideal solution is a two-state solution for Palestine and for Israel, where both peoples have their sovereign territory and can live in independence. I don't see that happening, but I do see some hope in that. I think the Netanyahu government's not going to be in power after this war is over, and there will possibly be a saner government in Israel that will start trying to end the occupation of the Palestinian territories and start at least moving towards, it's a situation where there are two rights clashing with each other, according to who interprets the history. So, for the Israelis, we are living in a place where we have ancestral roots, where we had to form a country because we were being killed all over the world, and we need an independent Jewish country. For the Palestinians, these were Western, colonialists coming in and taking territory that was our ancestral. When you have that, I talk about civil war in Vietnam, it's really a civil war between the two peoples for the same land. For me, an obvious solution then is, well, how do you learn to live together? How do you say, okay, that's your history, that's your interpretation, this is your history, and that's your interpretation. How do we stop killing each other? When you put the element of religion in there, it makes it that much harder on either side. So I'm very distressed and upset by it. And I don't know. I think the only light that's in at the end of this particular tunnel is getting rid of Netanyahu and hopefully getting rid of Hamas also, so that the saner people can prevail there.
Wayne, how old were you when you were deployed to Vietnam? How long were you in Vietnam? What was your experience personally there like?
I was 20, just turned 20 before I went to Vietnam. My experience, I was in the Marines. So at first, I was in a ground unit. We were tasked with actually protecting a helicopter facility. So it was a matter of, of living in foxholes and going on patrols and stuff like that. Eventually, I became a gunner on a helicopter. And I was originally stationed in Quang Nam province, a little north of the American base. You were on some hills north of the American base in Chulai. When I became a helicopter gunner, I was transferred to the Marble Mountains outside of Da Nang. And then as the war heated up, at first we were fighting against the Viet Cong. In July of 1966, the North Vietnamese sent some divisions over the border, over the DMZ, and we were all sent to Quang Tri to meet them. So we were fighting against the regular North Vietnamese army at that point. That was a lot bloodier, actually. So I was there a total of 18 months. There was a period where we had lost so many helicopters, we were sent to Okinawa to regroup for about a month and then came back. But including that, it was about 18 months. And again, from Quang Tri to Thuat Dien province around Wei and Phu Bai, and then north to, from Quang Nam, excuse me, to Thuat Thien, and then north to Quang Tri in that area.
As a Marine, was it compulsory for you to say yes to being enlisted for that war? Could you have said no? And does everyone stay there from 18, 12 to 18 months? And once that's done, you can now come back to America and not need to go to a war ever again? How does that work? Yeah.
Well, it depends on the well, first of all, I mean, once you were in, you couldn't say no. Once you're in the service, though, people, not in my time, but a couple of years later, there was a huge anti-war sentiment in the American Armed Forces, and people stopped. There were people who refused to go in the in, and there were people who refused to fight even in South Vietnam in the American Armed Forces from about 1970 to 1973. People were just completely disillusioned with the war. That wasn't the case when I was there. We didn't think about saying no, and we couldn't. That's what we'd signed up for and trained. Once your tour was over, you were finished with war, depending on how long your enlistment was. I was in for 4 years. I went to Vietnam in my second year, toward the end of my second year. So by the time I got back, my enlistment was over. I had a few more months and it was over. But if I had longer on my enlistment, I would have been sent back. So people were sent, back after they came back, as depending on how much time they had left on their military obligation.
And then, what year were you sent in, Wayne?
So 1966, and there's 66 and 67.
And what year did the war end?
Ended for Americans in 1973. That's when our final pullout was, and for the Vietnamese in 75, as you know.
Were there people that, could people choose to stay for longer if they wanted to?
Yeah, people did. Yeah, I extended 6 months to get on helicopters. I wanted to get off the ground, so. You could do that, and people would extend for various reasons.
And then when you came back to America, what was it like knowing that the war was still going on? You had a lot of friends there fighting, but now you're back in a completely safe Western country and you're far from it, but you know it's still happening and you could visualize what's happening. What was that experience like for the next 3, 4 years as the war kept going?
I mean, it was tough. I mean, there's a lot of kind of, I don't know, popular history about how veterans were spat upon and stuff like that because there was such a big anti-war movement in the States. I never ran into anything like that. What I mostly ran into was indifference. People didn't want to know about it. They were forced to watch it on the news if they watched the news, but they mostly didn't want to know about it. I went to college when I got back, so there was a lot going on about the war on campus, and I. As I said, I had turned against the war by at that point. And I had very mixed feelings about that because I did have friends still fighting over there. And it was not an easy decision to make to say, I kind of come to that point and say, I really don't think we should be there. On one sense, I felt like I was kind of, being a traitor to people still fighting over there. On the other hand, I felt like I don't want them to die over there. I don't think it's worth it. I want them to come home. It was weird. I mean, it was the idea of Vietnam was everywhere in those days. The country was on one hand obsessed with it, but for most people, unless they had somebody involved, I mean, they didn't want to know about it. On the college campuses, of course, everybody wanted to, it was a very, how can I say, active period.
Coming back in your early 20s, you're going to college, you just served 18 months in the Vietnam War. Like, you must have seen the world in a completely different lens than everyone, all your peers in the early 20s going through college. Was it hard to like connect with fellow people your age? And were you seen as a hero, someone that had this cool war story, or was it the complete opposite?
I mean, well, two things I'll say. One is about 20% of my college campus were veterans, and I was at a college of about 15,000 students. About 20% were veterans in those days. We were not, by most of the students and by ourselves, we were not regarded as heroes, certainly. Some of them were hostile, some of them were, your baby killers, not that many of them, but some of them were like that. A lot were curious, or they just didn't want to hear about it, So, I mean, I had, several girlfriends in college for the most part. I didn't want to talk about it with them and they didn't want to hear about it. So it was kind of, why would I want to, keep dwelling there? So it's very mixed because on one hand, you couldn't stop thinking about it and it was all around you. The anti-war movement was going on and everybody's concerned. But on the other hand, I don't know, people didn't want to know personally what that question you asked, what'd you do there? I mean, very few people I can remember ever asked me that. Most of the time I would not speak about it to them. That's still the case, I think, for a lot of us. We just don't want to talk about it. I've written a lot about it, but my son told me, you never told me anything about Vietnam. What are you talking about? I've written books about it. He said, yeah, but you never talked to me about it. And that's the case.
What was your relationship with the sort of local Vietnamese people when you were sort of in Vietnam? Because you're really young, you're in your 20s. Like, did you learn Viet? Did you befriended any sort of Vietnamese locals or villagers? Were there any sort of any Vietnamese lovers?
Well, no lovers, but but I was in a first period when I was there. We were in a perimeter, and there's several small villages, hamlets outside the perimeter. And we would go in there sometimes, you know, just on patrols, but also we would bring in a medic, what Marines call a corpsman, into the village, and we'd have like a medical clinic for people. I got very friendly with people in that village. I got invited to their houses sometimes to eat with them. I had high school French, so I could get by a little bit. You know, some of them still smoke French. I could get by a little bit with that. I learned, you know, a little Vietnamese words. But I mean, it was one of the reasons that I turned against the war is because, I mean, I personalized with the people in that village, and I knew what was going to happen to them. And this was I still have photos of that village. It was a very, you know, pristine rice-growing village, you know, all the houses were thatched. There were no brick houses in there, nothing like that. It was bamboo and thatch and everything else. And I got to see that for a lot of the Marines, we called their houses hooches, you know, which is like shacks. And, you know, and I got to see, this isn't somebody's hooch. This is their home. I was invited in and I got to meet people at that level. You know, there were several little kids that I always played with, you know, and so on. So, yeah. Anyway, I did have those kind of personal relations, at least while I was in that unit on the ground for, you know, this was about for about 7 months, I'd say. When I was in helicopters, no. I mean,
when you're on the ground, were you applying the strategy of that commander that had the strategy to go to villages, build a relationship, stay there?
We were. It wasn't, but we weren't. Officially, and that those kind of units were called combined action companies. We weren't officially a combined action company, but we were doing that type of strategy, yes. And that was largely because, you know, the local commander wanted us to do that, and because, I mean, there were Marines who hated doing that and would have nothing to do with, you know, and stayed hostile, but enough of us liked to do that.
Being a ground soldier, was it like the Vietnam war movies where you're carrying heavy backpacks, you got mud all over your faces, you got water up to your knees, and you're trenching through the forest, and you're holding guns, and there's people yelling around, and you have no idea what's happening?
Yeah, we didn't go on operations into the mountains or jungles, so I didn't have that experience. You know, I was covered with mud, but not doing that. So we had basically foxholes that we'd put sandbags around, and we lived in them. And then, you know, walking through jungle, it was just a scrub jungle around there. We would walk, since these were fairly local patrols, we didn't have the heavy packs or anything like that, but we were with our, you know, with our flak vests and helmets and weapons and all that stuff, and going through the, sometimes through paddies, sometimes through scrub jungle and so on, but just within a few kilometers of the of where our position was. Our main job was protecting that air base, that helicopter base, so we didn't stay, you know, we didn't stray far from that.
Was it based on soldiers' qualifications, or was it based on the luck of the draw where you'd be placed, whether you'd be building relationships, whether you'd just be doing sort of patrols around an area, or if you'd be actually sent into the jungles and sort of attacking something? Was it based on qualifications or luck of the draw?
As luck of the draw.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. For the combined action companies, participants were screened to make sure they weren't racist, basically, and that they had some affinity with the Vietnamese. But for all the other things you're talking about, I mean, it was just luck of the draw. Yeah.
Wayne, have you been to Vietnam since? Back to Vietnam since the war?
Many times. I've been back about 10 times, I'd say. I went first time for that book, to meet the writers that were going to be in the book and so on. And I stayed in the North. And then after that, I actually didn't go back to the South until my son was in university, and he was doing a student abroad program. And he went to Vietnam, and he took my records, and he went to a lot of the places where I had been, where I had fought. So he kind of inspired me to go back. And then I went back. Most of the time it was to meet with writers in the North, and then to travel with them. So after we became very friendly, it was just like, oh, you know, Wayne's coming, let's take a trip. So it's like, I was like an excuse to go, you know, on these trips. So we went all over the country, and sometimes we'd rent a bus, and I'd go with these, you know, Vietnamese writers and have a great time. Three times I took students also, once with New York University, once with George Mason University, and once with St. Mary's College. I took groups of students to to Vietnam. You know, we did what you just described. We'd go from north to south or from south to north, you know, and do the whole country. And then when I did that book about the soldier who wanted to bring back the documents, I went back to interview all of the people involved in Vietnam on that. And then we traveled with the family. He had killed this soldier whose name was Wong Nhuc Nam in battle. Well, it was actually a patrol in the Mon Yang Pass near Pleiku. And the body had been put into, it was not identified, but they knew it was with 36 other unidentified soldiers in a little cemetery near Pleiku. So the family said if we went with them to that cemetery, they had hired a medium and she would be able to identify the grave and they would disinter his remains and bring him back to the village. So we actually did that. You know, we traveled with the family to Pleiku and then to the cemetery, and the medium said it's this grave. When they dug it up, they found several things that, you know, belonged to the soldier actually. So we brought his remains back to the village and he was buried in the cemetery there.
Wow, wait, the medium is like a fortune teller. Is that the
Yeah,
case?
it's very popular because there's so many missing in action. There's 300,000 missing in action. So I mean, there's actually an institute, you know, an official government institute in Hanoi for mediums that, you know, and they're, you know, there's a widespread belief in them. And people use them for that reason to find the remains of relatives who, you know, just never came back from the war and, you know, who are considered wandering souls. They're not at rest because, you know, nothing of them has come back to the family, to the family altar. It was a very emotional trip, especially for my friend who had actually killed the guy face to face.
Does that mean, so there was a cemetery with 32 unidentified soldiers that died. The medium came in, was able to pick the one out of the 30, and once you dug it up, it
Yes.
was correct. Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, it's I tell people, you know, believe it or not, but you know, it's they found like the, you know, the guy who was killed was a medic and they found like hypodermic needles and yeah, stuff like that in the grave. So.
As a soldier and going through all like that, do you have any religious belief? Are you Christian? Do you believe in God? And obviously, seeing that medium, that's a completely different religion. That's like being spiritual. Where do you stand on sort of all of those things?
I'm pretty spiritual, but ethnically I'm Jewish. I was married. My wife passed away about 2 years ago. She's Buddhist. She was Buddhist. So, we followed both traditions in that way. So, I'm not very formally religious in any way. I don't go to, you know, services or do things like that, but I have, say, spiritual beliefs.
During those 18 months of deployment, Wayne, you must have made, quite a few friends, let's say 10. Out of like all your friends, like how many people were able to successfully make it back to the States, and are any of them still alive with you today? Any war buddies left?
I have some war buddies, not necessarily in the units I was in, though. I had one good friend who had been in the helicopter unit with me, and we stayed friends for many years, but he passed away a couple of years ago. And he was the last guy from my unit that I really had that connection with. I lost people, of course, you know, that never came back. But I still have, and I guess it's mostly among the guys who ended up being writers after the war. You know, we're sort of a community that knows and, you know each other. So quite a few of my friends come from that milieu, I guess. You know, some of them in a lot of the same operations I was in, particularly in Quang Tri in the north, but, you know, but not in the same unit.
Did you meet any people that you met, any Vietnamese people that you met during deployment in those 10 times that you came back to Vietnam? Any villagers, any of the kids that you were playing with?
Yeah, never met them. Never got back to that village for one thing. And I've always been kind of afraid to get back there. That's, yeah, I don't know what happened to them. I was close at one point. We were on Highway 1 near Chu Lai, but I was with the students at that point and we couldn't, you know, I don't think there was a road out there anyway, so I don't know how we would have gotten there. I might have met some from the other side that I might have shot at during the war, but we won't know that.
That's crazy how like there's still villages till this day where there's no roads to them, and it's sort of like you have to go off road, and if it's already hard to get to those villages now, it must have been harder back then.
Oh yeah, I mean, It's nothing like the roads you have now. It's Route 9 in Kwangtyur, south of the Des Moines. That's like a nice concrete highway. That was a dirt path. All of those were, yeah.
During your deployment, Wayne, did you get into any fights? Did you kill any soldiers, or was it not visible since you were on the aeroplane? Or like,
When I was being shot at, I shot at people. I don't know if I hit anybody. I can't think of anybody that I actually saw being hit by my fire. And the helicopter mostly, fired at flashes.
yeah. And then coming back, were there any trauma? Was there any PTSD? And if not, compared to those that had it, what do you think differed?
I don't think anybody comes back completely untraumatized. And I had periods that were hard for me and, dreams and stuff like that. I think the fact that I became a writer and was able to deal with things in my writing, and particularly, I'm mostly a fiction writer. The first things I was writing were stories about the war, but fictionalized. So I was able to kind of, get the experience out, get it out of my head, but also to kind of put it at a little distance because I was doing it as fiction. And that was very helpful. And working with people like that, I mean, that when I got back, actually starting in 72, 73, I worked with other veterans to put together a collection of our fiction. We formed a publishing company because nobody was publishing our stuff. Nobody wanted to publish anything that was coming out of Vietnam. Basically, that, no, there's no market for this stuff. We don't want to do it. So we got together, three of us got together and basically formed a publishing company, nonprofit. We put out the first two collections from Vietnam veterans. And later they were actually so successful that a major publisher picked them up, and then we did like a joint operation with them. But when I say we put together a publishing company, I mean we lived together. It's like, we rented a house, and we were all so it was. Yeah, we always had that kind of community that was very helpful. We're working towards something we believed in. We were kind of getting the war out of ourselves, and in that way, we're doing it together. So it was very, very helpful in that way. There are still times today I'll think of things and get depressed by it, and
Wayne, what were the toughest things that you had to see and process?
some of the in two different ways. Some of the brutality against the Vietnamese really bothered me a lot. And these were people who were, I didn't see anybody being murdered, but I saw people who were very abusive, sometimes physically abusive, and so on. And out of the kind of racism that really bothered me because as I said, I'd gone there thinking we were going there to help, people. Some of the other things were, I mean, I wasn't there 2 weeks when we got called to where there was a major operation. We were called to help unload the dead and the wounded from the helicopters. I remember I still have this image that there was a line of about, it might have been 50 corpses, Marines, and they were all, and it was raining, and we put ponchos over them, but their boots were sticking out. And we all had these boots, they were jungle boots. And my boot, at that point, by 2 weeks, they were covered with mud. And I was looking at the boots of those guys and looking at my boots, and they were, I can't, is this realization that when you're young, it's hard to realize, intellectually you can die, but emotionally you don't accept it. And looking at those corpses and looking at their boots, it was the same, they were wearing my boots. I literally felt they were wearing my boots. And that image, that's always stayed in my mind. Seeing, the missions that I think were the most meaningful, but also the worst for me were medical evacuations, where we'd go in and take out the wounded and the dead. And I can remember being literally standing behind my machine gun in a helicopter, literally being knee deep. We were in the 46 as a sea nights with people with horrible wounds and corpses, all around me, getting out of a zone, being shot at, and at the same time, but all of these people that we were just, taking out like meat. Those are the toughest times, I think.
So you would like fly in, land in a territory where there's like enemies around you. You're trying to get corpses, injured people onto the helicopter, and at the same time people are shooting at you. So you're trying to save people, but you're so worried of your own back. And then you also need to leave quickly so that the helicopter isn't going to get shot, and a fuel leakage would come, and that would be all happening at the same time.
Yeah, and that, I mean, the one memory I had is this was a this operation on the in Quang Tri, where The first day of that operation, there were four helicopters lost. I mean, there's somebody took a photograph, which I, still have my files. There was one of them that was on fire on the way down, and it had the, crew of four and 13 Marines, 13, and they, they all, well, they didn't all die. Actually, the crew chief got out. He was burned, but he was the only one that got out of that crash. And then the other helicopters went down. It was in this valley, which we later called Helicopter Valley, because there was just these shot down helicopters along. And that was near the area we went in at night. And that particular images I was talking about, that was a night medevac, which makes it worse because, it's pitch black. And to mark the landing zone, somebody on the ground will hold up a strobe light. You got to find the strobe light and go down. And then you see the North Vietnamese. Do you know what tracers are? Tracer bullets. They're in a machine gun. Every fifth round has a incendiary part so that it glows when you shoot it, so you can direct it. You know where your fire is going. And the American tracers are red, and the North Vietnamese tracers are green. So you see these, green tracers coming at you at the same time. All this stuff is going on. Yeah, anyway, not pleasant memories.
Yeah, when you talked about seeing the abuse, like, was it Americans abusing like local South Vietnamese? Was it Viet Congs? Was it captured North Vietnamese soldiers? What type of abuse were you sort of seeing?
Well, I mean, I did see with some Viet Cong prisoners that were, they were squatting and they had these sandbags over their head and people were kicking them. But mostly it was, I mean, it's incidents that I remember in that village. Went out on a patrol and we were going near the village, and this guy that one of the Vietnamese that I had met was coming up this path on a bicycle, and the Marine in front of me just as he came close, the guy was kind of smiling at me. As he came close, the Marine next to me, butt stroked him off the bicycle in the jaw. I mean, like that. Why the hell did you do that? And he said, and I, the Marine was just, I mean, he was on one hand scared, but he was also just racist, And I was in my foxhole that night, or not, I don't remember which, that in the evening, not the same day, but I was with a guy who had been in a regular infantry unit and was had been in country a longer time, and I told him, what happened, and he took out a Polaroid, and it was a picture of some Vietnamese bodies, and they weren't all soldiers. I mean, there were some women and stuff, and they were pretty shot up, and he said this was an ambush we did in Quang Nhai, and he, and I just told him that story, and he said, where the hell do you think you are? He's saying, that's the real, that's the, what you saw was nothing. That's the reality of this place. And then, I mean, there were just little incidents that you would see like that, the pejoratives, calling Vietnamese gooks and stuff like that. It was just one of the reasons main reasons I turned against the war.
Yeah, because it seems so contradictory that you would come to this country, fight for the South Vietnamese, only to be racist towards them.
Yeah, like, I mean, for a lot of the Americans were just, ignorant 19-year-olds who knew nothing about, nothing. I didn't know anything about the country either, for that matter, but nothing about the history. And again, they were in a situation where you didn't know who was the enemy and who was a friend. And then, for a lot of them, it became, especially people who started losing friends, it became they're all the enemy. It's easier to think that way, safer to think that way. And you put in the factors that people are, if they are a different race and a different language, and they live in these places, that it becomes like a recipe to dehumanize people.
When you've been back to Vietnam over the last 10 times, what has your experience been with the people? Have you been shunned? Have they been racist to you as an American coming back to Vietnam, or has it been the opposite?
No, I mean, there was a couple of times when some people gave me some hateful look, but they were the exception, very much the exception. I mean, people, were always friendly, and I think particularly with the veterans from both sides, for that matter. But even with the North Vietnamese veterans or the VC veterans, it's like we had more in common than the people who hadn't been in a war, whether in Vietnam or in America. It's like we had that in common, and it's I asked one of my writer friends, how come you have to be so easy on forgiving us and all this stuff? And he said, we've been fighting big powers for all of our history. We can't afford to keep grudges. It's very practical, We can't afford to keep grudges with people. He said it hurts us more than it hurts them. So
What was the reason you chose to enlist in the army, Wayne? When you enlisted prior to being sort of sent over, was the Vietnam War happening? Were all your fellow 19, 20-year-old sort of peers, did they?
I enlisted before, just when I got out of high school, because in those days there was a draft, and I was, not that I was not a good student in high school, so I wasn't going to college or university. So pretty much I was gonna, everybody in my neighborhood, I was gonna have a pretty working class neighborhood, and everybody knew you were gonna either be drafted or you're going to enlist. And I had one friend who was really, very much into the Marines and all that, and he wanted to go in, so we went in as friends, not knowing very much. But that was, as I said, that was 2 years before I ended up going to Vietnam, and the war was just an advisory stage at that point. Nobody was even talking about Vietnam. I'm gonna have to go pretty soon.
I'm gonna let you go, Wayne, but I want to thank you so much for your time today. Wayne, where can people find more about your story, get your books? Where are the best places for people to get more of Wayne?
Well, you can Google me or go on Amazon. I have a website I can email to you if you want to put that up. But yeah, you can just Google my name or just go on Amazon and get all my books are listed there.
And is it just waynecarlin.com?
It's Squarespace, WayneCarlin.com.
We'll link it in the description as well, so people, and we'll pop it up on the screen. But thank you so much for your time, Wayne. I love how sort of passionate you are about this topic. You've definitely, when you came back, you talked about doing research and looking into the history. You know about the French and Cambodia. It's like this is something that you've really delved into, and you've been so generous with your stories today. And I learned a lot sort of through this conversation. It's cool to sort of see how all the different topics we hit and how broad this conversation has been. So I really appreciate your time and expertise today.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure talking to you, Andy.
Thank you so much, Wayne. Guys, if you made it this far into the podcast, hopefully you guys got some value from today's episode. Please let me know your thoughts, and I'll see you guys next week on another episode. Peace.